You're back in the Grey Lodge, and it's Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 12. And it's time to rock. That's right. The episode's called Let's Rock, and it's one of the bangers. We get the background on the U.S. Air Force's Project Blue Book and Blue Rose cases. We talk about red curtains, a critical Sarah Palmer scene that I linked to the Laura Palmer turkey theory, and an incredible link I found to James Shelby Downard's JFK King Kill 33. But most importantly, Audrey Horne is back. Join me in the Grey Lodge as we dissect Twin Peaks The Return, Part 12. Now, this episode will take us back to previous Twin Peaks. You know, and that's what happens throughout all of The Return, if you pay attention. The first time I watched The Return, I didn't see nothing from the original series. I was completely clueless. But now that I've watched it enough, I'm like, oh, man. There's so much reference to season one and two, it's pretty crazy. We, of course, the title of the episode is called Let's Rock, and if you recall, we saw that on the windshield of FBI Special Agent Chet Desmond's car at the trailer park in Firewalk with Me, and season one, episode three, in the Red Room, the man from another place said, Let's Rock. So, what's gonna happen? I don't know. Let's find out. Gordon Cole, Albert, and Tammy, they're sharing a drink, and they actually read her into the Blue Rose investigations. That's right. We get the full history of the Blue Rose that segued off of the Project Blue Book UFO investigation, and they invite Tammy into Blue Rose. Big deal. Big moves for Tammy. And afterwards, I'm going to play this clip. It's kind of long. Yeah, I'm going to play this clip because afterwards they have Diane come in the room. Take a listen.
In 1970, the United States Air Force shut down Project Blue Book, their 20-year investigation into UFOs. They concluded that no credible evidence existed and therefore they posed no threat to national security. In other words, a massive cover-up. Cheers. A few years later, the military and FBI formed a top-secret task force to explore the troubling abstractions raised by cases Blue Book failed to resolve. We called it the Blue Rose after a phrase uttered by a woman in one of these cases just before she died, which suggested these answers could not be reached except by an alternate path we've been traveling ever since. Gordon suggested an agent by the name of Philip Jeffries to head the squad. He soon recruited three others. Myself, Chet Desmond, and Dale Cooper. Perhaps you haven't failed to notice that I'm the only one of that group who hasn't disappeared without explanation, which has led to a certain reluctance on Gordon's part to bring new blood into the fold. Until tonight. Agent Preston, you've been on our radar since you made the honors list at George Washington High, not to mention the dean's list at MIT and top of your class at Quantico.
You're asking me to join the Blue Rose Task Force?
Yep.
I'm in.
I'll brief you in detail in the morning.
Tammy and the Blue Rose.
Blue Rose.
The Blue Rose.
So it turns out Project Blue Book was shut down by the Air Force. They finessed the public, said there's nothing going on here. A massive cover-up, as Albert says. A few years later, this top-secret task force called Blue Rose comes through, and the reason why is because the first case was a woman, and she said Blue Rose? And I'd love to learn more about that. And they say it's a reference to traveling an alternative path. Now, if you recall, I previously suggested a theory that Blue Rose is symbolic for the left-hand path, the Luciferian path. Therefore, an alternative path. I don't know. Just an idea. We'll keep going. We hear about Gordon Cole, Albert, Philip Jeffries, Chet Desmond, and Dale Cooper, all part of the Blue Rose Task Force. And Albert even notes how most of those people are missing. So they formally get Tammy to join the Blue Rose. Pretty big deal, okay? So afterwards, they call Diane. And remember, they're real suspicious of Diane. She's doing all kinds of weird stuff. Texting Mr. C. And on the clip, and I'll put the photo on the Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt, like and subscribe. They bring Diane into the room, and you'll notice she walks through a red curtain. Just like, you know, the red room. And they have a discussion with her, and you have to watch the clip to notice some of her body language doesn't really add up. So let's get into this clip with Diane.
Diane, we know your work with Agent Cooper has given you more than a passing insight into the Blue Rose. Even though you're no longer a part of the Bureau, we'd like to deputize you.
On a temporary basis, because we really need your help.
What's in it for me?
Some cash. Not much. Maybe the satisfaction of learning what happened to your friend Cooper.
Let's rock.
So they ask her to temporarily help out. She's a jerk about it, of course. And she replies, "Let's rock." And Gordon Cole knocks on the table in confirmation. And like I said earlier, "Let's rock" is very waiting room, red room, possibly Black Lodge-ish. And I wonder, when I watched this, I thought, why the red curtains? Like, hotel rooms don't have red curtains, unless it's to the window, right? They for sure put this there on purpose. Did Gordon Cole and Albert set up the room with red curtains to trigger a response from Diane to show her true self? Because remember, Gordon Cole's suspicious of her. He said, "I knew something was wrong with this chick. It didn't seem right. And she's been doing weird stuff with Mr. C." And then her face contorts and you hear the whooshing sound when she says, "Let's rock." Which is the whooshing sounds you hear from Fire Walk With Me. So I kind of think they were setting it up for a test, and now they're like, okay, she's Black Lodge. Black Lodge confirm, I guess. Jerry Horn's still struggling. Okay, then Sarah Palmer. This one's a biggie. This is a biggie. We're going to revisit this in the conclusion to season three, to the final wrap-up, Twin Peaks Theory. It doesn't seem like it. When you watch the scene, you're like, this is crazy. What are we doing here? I'm going to play the clip, but what's happening here is Sarah Palmer is grocery shopping at a grocery store called Carrie's. All right. I don't know if you remember. A couple episodes, there was that woman in that minivan and her son shot that gun. Remember when Bobby came out and saved the day? Her name was Carrie also. Is there a relation? I don't know. But Sarah Palmer's grocery shop for booze, I mean, Bloody Mary's seems to be her drink. She snags the last three bottles of vodka and gets a carton of Salem's. But she has this interaction with the at the register that's very strange. Take a listen.
How much is it?
$133.70.
I don't remember seeing those beef jerky there before.
That's new.
What type is it?
It's turkey, not beef.
Is it smoked?
I think so. It's the same as beef jerky, except made from turkey.
Were you here when they first came?
Yes. They brought it in a couple weeks ago.
Your room seems different. And men are coming.
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
I am trying to tell you that you have to watch out. Things can happen. Something happened to me. Something happened to me. I don't feel good. I don't feel good.
Stop doing this.
Leave this place. Get the car key.
Now, what happened here was Sarah is freaking out about the beef jerky display behind the cash register. And I'll put the image on the Instagram, but what if you're just listening, half of the display has turkey jerky and the other half is beef jerky. All right. And she's freaking out. And when I was watching this just now, I noticed the turkey jerky and I thought, well, that's interesting. I literally just talked about Laura Palmer being the turkey, right? Remember the turkey and the corn that we talked about last episode on the map of Twin Peaks, the Alden map. But Sarah sees the jerky. She insists that the jerky wasn't there before. And she asks what type it is. And the girl, Victoria, that works in the register, she specifically talks about the turkey jerky. And I thought, that's, you know, illuminate, confirm. That's a fact now. The turkey jerky threw Sarah Palmer off. Why? Why not the beef jerky? It's because Laura is the one, and she represents the turkey. She is the savior, and it's almost like Sarah is reminded of Laura, and she's freaking out. Why? Is it just a painful reminder? She asks the girl a strange question. She says, were you here when that jerky came in? And the chick was like, yeah. And then Sarah starts talking about how everything seems different. All right. And then she says, men are coming. You have to watch out. Things can happen. Something happened to me. I don't feel good. And then she says, Sarah, stop doing this to me. As if she's not in control of her own body. As if it's a spirit is within her or something. And she directs herself to get the car key and she storms out without the groceries. Now, like I said, we're going to come back to this. It's a very important scene, I think, into what I will have as the overall theory for Twin Peaks The Return. I feel like Sarah senses a shift in realities. That's why she says, were you here when that jerky came in? The room feels different. An alternate reality that she realizes, and the turkey is a reminder of Laura in some form or fashion. All right. Then we're over to Fat Trout, Carl Rods, talking to a man named Chris Cole about how he shouldn't sell his blood for rent money. Not sure what that's about. We see Dougie's neighborhood in Las Vegas. The camera pans over the home, or the camera is kind of like a bird's eye view for a minute. And if you watch that scene, you see the shadow of something fly over Dougie's house. That's surely an owl. And that was on purpose, I'm sure. It was just a shadow CGI'd in or something. I guarantee that's an owl. Then we go back to Twin Peaks. Hawk heads over to the beautiful 708 Everett Street, where, you know, it's the Laura Palmer home in Everett. And, not Everett Street, 708 33rd Street. I got to change my notes. How dare I? 708 33rd Street, Everett, Washington. In fact, if you Google Laura Palmer's house, that's the address that comes up. So, and shout out to Mary Reber. She let me in there. Remember, we interviewed her, and she was an amazing person. If you ever get the chance, please, for the love of God, take advantage of her generous hospitality to check out the home. I think she has a website as of this recording that you can book a tour of the house. Now, we get to the Hawk pulls up to the Palmer house, and you'll notice from the outside immediately the grass and the bushes are all dead. Mary Reber told me about how they were purposely killing all of her plants and grass for that shot. They want it to look like it's in a state of disarray, like something's wrong, something's off. All right. And you even see the ceiling, the iconic ceiling fan through the house, through Laura's window. And you hear the season one music queuing up, and it's like reminiscent nostalgia here, right? And Sarah answers the door. She's a bit hostile. They chat, and I'm going to play the clip. Listen, because Hawk hears some glass breaking in the house, but who's in there with her, right? And Sarah just says, it's something in the kitchen. Take a listen.
Hello, sir.
Hawk.
I'm meaning to stop by. Some old cases popped up, and I thought about you.
That's very kind of you. But I suppose you're really here because of what happened in the grocery store.
Yeah, I heard about that. People were worried about you.
I just don't know what came over me.
You're okay now.
I feel fine now.
Somebody in the house?
No. No, just something in the kitchen.
You're okay then.
Something goddamn bad story, isn't it, Hawk?
Sir, if you need any help, if you need anything, I want you to call, okay? I mean it. Help of any kind.
Thanks, Hawk.
So the whole scene's really awkward. Sarah's hostile. Hawk just says he's over there. Hey, if you need any help. And he said something about how he's there because the Laura Palmer case popped up. Sarah's angry, though. She's mad. We see a shot of Miriam. She's recovering in the hospital room. She's in a coma, though. Then Diane is texting about Las Vegas to Mr. C. Then Frank Truman goes to see Ben Horn to tell him, like, hey, your grandson Richard Horn is an awful person. He killed a little boy, and now the woman who was a witness and tried to, you know, tell us about it, Miriam, she's in the ICU. She's got no insurance. And Ben Horn offers to take care of the cost. Ben says, that boy's never been right. And you hear that Harry Truman had a bunch of run-ins with Richard. Ben said that he was going to ironically send the Great Northern Room 315 key to Harry that just showed up at the Great Northern, right? Remember, because Jade dropped it in the mail after she picked up Dougie and all that in like episode 3 or whatever. And Frank's like, wow, that's really strange. After all these years, we started looking at that Cooper case again and that key showed up, right? Because there's lots of synchronicities happening rapidly in this show. And Truman leaves, and then you hear Ben tell Beverly that Richard never had a father. Huh. We already ascertained that Audrey has to be Richard's mother, because the only siblings are Richard and Johnny. So either Johnny is Richard's father, which probably isn't true, or Audrey is the mother. So who is the father? So Albert goes to Gordon Cole's hotel room, and Cole's in there with an attractive woman. Takes about 15 minutes for her to leave. And Albert tells Cole about the text because they're now tracking the text. They don't trust Diane. And he says, look, she got a message that said Las Vegas. And Diane replied, they haven't asked yet. What are we talking about? And they don't really go any further. Meanwhile, Mr. C's two assassins, they were instructed to stake out the warden and kill him. And they do. They kill him in front of his house. They're very blasé about the whole thing. They're more interested in making sure they get some Wendy's. Dr. Jacoby's still doing his Dr. Amp conspiracy theorist thing. He's selling gold shovels. That's his boner juice, is the gold shovels. Two coats guaranteed. Dig yourself out of the shit. Nadine's still eating it up. And I noticed Dr. Amp's got an entire script written out for his show. He uses magic marker on paper to rant and rave. It must take him all day. He's got time, I guess. Then, out of nowhere, holy shit, it's Audrey Horne. What? Out of nowhere, there's Audrey Horne, and she's staring at this guy, this little guy sitting at his desk. And this scene makes no sense. But I do want to direct your attention to the shot we have of Audrey Horne, because we've been waiting for her for 25 years and 2 months now or whatever. And you'll notice there's a ton of disheveled books all throughout the room. But right next to her, the two titles you can read right next to Audrey Horne when the camera is like zoomed in on her. The first one is T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Now, I'm an illiterate jerk. I don't know anything about what that is. So Wikipedia says four quartets are four interlinked meditations with a common theme being man's relationship with time, the universe, and the divine. Recall the log lady talking about all this just a couple episodes ago. In describing his understanding of the divine within the poems, Eliot blends his Anglo-Catholicism with mystical, philosophical, and poetic works from both Eastern and Western religious and cultural traditions, with references to the Bhagavad Gita and the pre-Socratics, as well as the Christian mystics, John of the Cross and Julian of Norwich. Okay, but what I want to talk about is the other book. The other book you can see the title of is called Happy Times. And this turns out to be a photo book by none other than Lee Radziwill. And that name should ring a bell. All right, let me read the Amazon description. Again, never seen it. I don't know what this book is. But the Amazon description says, leafing through a wealth of private photo albums and personal archives, Lee Radziwill offers a unique perspective of happy times, from the first trip to Europe and the Bouvier sisters to fond memories of Christmas in Palm Beach with President Kennedy. From her years in London to summer days in Konka, Lee Radziwill has enjoyed a very colorful and successful life. She brings alive, with humor and feeling, privileged moments with family and friends. Happy Times is the credo of a lady who, having witnessed historical moments and shared the lives of characters struck by fate, has made the deliberate choice of only remembering what's beautiful. Through anecdotes and pictures, personal notes and drawings, Happy Times offers readers a very personal perspective on a highly publicized life. So, what we're talking about is a book by Caroline Lee Bouvier, who was Jackie Onassis's younger sister. And this is all over the King Kill 33 book by James Shelby Downard, all right? Now, stranger yet, you know, because we talked about James Shelby Downard a whole bunch already in the Twin Peaks series. I think I even have an entire King Kill 33 breakdown I will do at some point. Did I do that yet? I don't think I did it yet. I think I talked about it several times on this show because I think it's influential to Twin Peaks. I've got a deep dive into it that I'll probably do after we're done with Twin Peaks on the regular sort of feed. But fun fact, Caroline Lee Bouvier attempted to be an actress, and her first TV appearance was an adaptation of a movie called Laura. So, look, I don't know what to make of all that exactly, right? But when you get into the ideas of the elites and, you know, the Bouviers and the Kennedys and marrying these, like, they're marrying into royalty. That's how she ended up with the name Radziwill. Prince Radzivill. It's very interesting, right? And it ties into all of that King Kill 33 stuff. So, for sure, that book was placed there on purpose by Frost and or Lynch. Now, back to Audrey, though. We've been waiting so long. What are you doing? She's staring down her husband, Charlie. He's a little person, right? Reminding me of the man from another place. And look, I can read you the whole script here. It doesn't make any sense. She's on her way to the roadhouse to look for someone who's been missing for 2 days named Billy. Her husband, Charlie, is more worried about his work. He says it's a new moon and it's dark out. She thinks he's a loser. She's really mean to him. She's having sex with a guy named Billy and in love with him, but she's still married to Charlie. Somehow he's blasé about it. She says that she saw Billy in her dream last night, bleeding from his nose and mouth, and she even says sometimes dreams are real. They're talking about how Tina was the last person to saw Billy. And the only thing that makes any sense out of this is back on Twin Peaks of the Return Part 7, at the Double R Diner, someone frantically yelled inside asking if anyone's seen Billy. And I believe that was a character played by David Lynch's son, Riley, from what I saw. She talks about she wants him to sign some papers and run them by his lawyer. No clue. It did remind me of season 1, episode 6, when Catherine, remember, she was approached to sign a life insurance with Josie as the beneficiary, but she was real sus about it because it was set up by Ben. They just go back and forth. I mean, I don't know if any of this has relevance to anything in Twin Peaks The Return, to be honest, besides frustrating the heck out of people. But Charlie reluctantly is like, okay, I'll go to the roadhouse with you. And they talk about how a guy named Chuck, was the one who said Tina was the last one to see Billy. And Charlie says that Chuck stole Billy's truck and Billy called the sheriff. And it made me think Richard stole that truck earlier. Is that the same guy? I don't know. Does it matter? I don't think so. Charlie calls Tina to ask if she was, in fact, the last one to see Billy. She says something that he seemed shocked by. He won't tell Audrey what it was. And that's the end of the scene. We waited 25 years and 12 episodes for Audrey Horne. And what did David Lynch give us? Lots of incoherent arguing about a guy named Billy? What are we doing, David? Come on, Lynch. What are we doing? It's not easy being a Twin Peaks fan sometimes. So meanwhile, Diane is on her phone looking up the coordinates that she saw in Ruth Davenport's dead arm. We'll finally figure out. You know, we heard earlier Albert say it's up north is all we heard. And we get confirmation on the map. The coordinates take us to the town of Twin Peaks. And recall the whole idea that we had approached of starting over when we talked about the last episodes when the log lady called Hawk and said the circle was closing, right? They're prepping us for something big. And then we go to the Roadhouse, one of my favorite songs from the entire universe of Twin Peaks, The Chromatics. Two women are talking about more unknown characters, Clark, Angela, and Mary. Who cares? A man named Trick, another, who cares, shows up freaking out about how he almost got killed, heading to the bar. And, that's where basically the episode ends. A banger of an episode, though, regardless of the frustrating introduction of 6, 7, 8 unknown, unneeded characters. Why is this happening? Why did we get Audrey Horne and it's not what we wanted? Doesn't matter, though. We got Audrey back, so good news for that. So there you go. We're going to revisit that Sarah Palmer character, boy. We're going to revisit that when this is all said and done. So, till then, I need you to watch the next episode, Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 13. What story is that, Charlie? Implying maybe we get more Audrey. I don't know. We'll see. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for supporting. Till next time, stay positive.